Your Steve Jones Show podcast will start shortly. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Brewers Outlet, your beverage supermarket on Reagan Street in Sunbury. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to have you with us. Brought to you today by our good friends at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Imports domestic microbrews, best selection of beer anywhere. Big weekend. Stock up for the eclipse. Really, stock up for the eclipse. This is it. Big. It's going to be on Monday here in State College, 238, 77% of the sun obliterated by the moon. Some say it's the end of the world. I ask the question, if that's the case, do I have to speak at Harrisburg tonight? Pabst Blue Ribbon 24-pack, 16-ounce can, $16.98. Smith & Forge 12-pack, $8.77. 24-pack, $16.98. Wine coolers, water, soft drinks, snacks. They roast their peanuts fresh and hot every day. The pickle bar, second to none, led up by the barrels and the dills. We're in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And now the play-by-play call of the day. Philip Irvin with a big two-run homer.
1-0 to Irvin. Hit hard and high and deep, and I mean way out of here. Two-run home run for Philip Irvin, his second game in a row that the big fella has gone way back. And the Reds have taken an 11-9 lead here at Wrigley.
They ended up winning. The Reds did 13-10 over the Chicago Cubs. All right, final half hour. Tom Van Riper is going to join us. Talk about the Reds and the Dodgers and their rivalry in the 70s. Wrote a book about that entitled Cincinnati Red Dodger Blue. That's in the final half hour. We bring in my brother this half hour. And, again, I pose the question, if the end of the world with the solar eclipse is Monday, do I have to go to Harrisburg to speak tonight?
I don't know, but I'm getting cheesecake, and I'm getting carrot cake with triple-decker carrot cake, because I am just like, I'm losing it, man. And Reese's peanut butter cups, the big ones, the big thick ones, I'm getting them.
And I feel like an idiot, because I actually went to my six-month doctor appointment earlier in the week. I'm thinking to myself, should I have gone?
You ought to be healthy when you're dead. That's cool.
Yeah, right. Hey, I feel better now.
Hey, did you hear about goodness. Yaki Way?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, you look, Yaki Way, when you and I were kids, was actually Jersey Street.
Yeah.
I mean, so look, I have no attachment to it. I could care less. If they wanted to change it, fine. It used to be, it was Jersey Street when we were kids growing up. I mean, I've heard about that John Henry wants it to be changed. Now, he can't change it. It's something the city of Boston has to do. And if they did it, fine.
That's so stupid. Then change every John F. Kennedy High School and Junior High School to another name. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. Just let it go. I mean, I don't want to get into a talk like that, but my God, where does it end? You know, John F. Kennedy was a rotten man. Period. Cheated on his wife, had mistresses all over the place, but that's okay. You know, we're going to have to change the whole state of Massachusetts. It's crazy.
Wow.
I don't know. You just let history be history and have your beliefs, and if you don't like looking at something, then don't look at it. That's it. But you can't start tearing everything down. It's crazy.
Patriots, by the way, their defensive end, Derek Rivers, looks like he tore his ACL. And Georgia Tech today had to dismiss their leading rusher from last year, Dedrick Mills, for a violation of athletic department rules. And then here's one of my favorites. Okay. NewJersey.com, NJ.com, and they're associated with the Newark Star Ledger, right, Sean? That sounds right. Mm-hmm. NJ.com?
NJ.com. Yeah.
And NJ Advance Media. They wanted to write a story on New Jersey players with Michigan football. Like Rashawn Gary, for example. And if, look, if you're Michigan football, this is a positive story. Well, they wanted to look online as to, and to count how many New Jersey players were with Michigan football. And when they put it up online, they got the 2016 roster. So they called over to the athletic department and said, hey, is there any way, you know, are we looking in the wrong spot that we can get a 2017 roster? They said, we're not putting out a 2017 roster until the week, until a couple days before the Florida game, which is the opener. And they said, you're not putting out a roster? They don't put out depth charts. They said, but you're not putting out a roster? So NJ.com has gone to court for a Freedom of Information Act request to get the roster, because Jim Harbaugh won't give it to anybody. And they said, and Michigan says they'll respond to the request in their legal brief by August 25th, which is 8 days before, which is 8 days before their first game. That's such a game. I mean, look, no offense, but these aren't the nuclear codes. It's a roster.
To Jim Harbaugh, it's a nuclear code.
I know.
Hey, well, at least he cares about his program, right? I mean, he makes it number one. He's willing to put himself out there and let people beat him up. I mean, he does it for what he thinks is the good of the school. I don't know. Why get yourself beat up for nothing? So.
Depth chart is one thing. I mean, you could put out any depth chart you want. It doesn't mean that's who you're going to start anybody
right,
you want.
Right.
I mean, what I do is I put in a Michigan tape and I go through and go, okay, 73, 51, 52, 64, and 70. That's the offensive line. Okay. I mean, that's how I do it. I just put a tape in and go through it and I mark it down.
Can't he do the same thing with the roster and name 50 guys who didn't even try out for the team? No one would know the difference.
Well, yeah, but you do have to put out a legitimate roster at some point, because name and number has to match up.
Right.
You have to do it for the public address announcer. You have to do it for the crowd. You just can't, you know. You know,
hey. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to change the subject. You see Bobby Orr's, nephew or whatever's in the College World Series?
Is he really?
Yeah, he plays for the Canadian team. His name's Robert Orr.
Oh, jeez.
How cool is that? You know? He's a great guy, Bobby Orr. But
everybody tells you that.
I don't know if it's his nephew or what, you know, grandson? I'm not sure. But Robert Orr is related to Bobby Orr.
Bobby Orr now lives on Cape Cod. He's part owner in the Sandwich Country Club.
He's a great guy.
Everybody says that. Zero ego, down to earth.
Yeah.
I always tell this story that WBZ in Boston wanted to do the Legends of Boston. And they brought in, it had to be one from each sport. Now, this is before, let's see. Yeah, so they brought in Brady, Ted Williams,
Larry Bird
and Bobby Orr. When they were done, everybody got their cars, and Orr walked up and asked if they validated parking. He drove himself.
Yeah. No, that's Orr. They should change the name of every John F. Kennedy High School to Bobby Orr High. That would be cool, huh?
Yeah, yesterday, Robert Orr, Bobby's grandson, went 1 for 3 with 3 RBIs. It was Canada defeated Italy 12-2, 4 innings. They stopped at 10-run rule after 4 in the opening round of the Little League World Series.
Good.
So, yeah, Canada moves on to the winner's bracket games tomorrow.
That is on my bucket list.
I am going
to the Little League World Series someday. So.
Yeah, you and I should go together, because you know what? I mean, I've up into the fields a couple of times, but I've never actually been to a game there. And, you know, we're close, and I've got an offer from somebody to go and sit in specific seats.
Yeah.
Good friend of mine, Barry Rake, up there.
I mean, will I have to sit someplace
else? No, you know, you can go with me. And, I mean, it doesn't cost anything.
How about my wife?
Yeah, sure, we all can go.
How about Sean? Sean wants to go, too.
I'm in.
Sean's going on Sunday night to the Cardinals-Pirates game.
I'm so jealous. So.
Yeah, he's going to the Cardinals-Pirates game. You'll say,
oh, yeah, I heard that. I listened to the show yesterday.
Yeah, so. Tim Kirchen is, we just had him on the previous half hour.
Mm-hmm.
He's working the game. But I think that when you, that it's one of the really neat things they're doing. But I remember one year, for example, I went up and I spoke to the Little League umpires luncheon.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I had to get back to do the show. So I couldn't stay. So even then, I have not had a chance to go to a game. At some point, I will. When does the Little League World Series end?
That'll be next Sunday.
27th? All right.
I just, what a vacation. Just spend the week down there, you know, go to all the games, watch the international games. I love the spirit of it. It's just great. It's on my bucket list, that and the Masters. But I don't know, but I'd rather do the Little League World Series than the Masters. So.
Oh, I had a chance to go to the Masters a couple of years ago, and then there was plane trouble. Couldn't go.
You wouldn't risk it?
No.
I do airplane parts. So I'm not flying, man. No way.
That'd be the case.
Some of the stuff that goes on.
Kevin, you and I'd be hosting the show now.
The fact that you do airplane parts has me rethinking.
We make airplane parts and candle holders.
There's a dynamic combination. That inspires a lot of confidence.
Oops, shipped the wrong part to the wrong place.
Whoops.
Two hearts, one flame, one plane.
Oh, there you go. Two hearts.
Sitting in the cockpit. Sitting in the cockpit. The two hearts, one flame.
X number of thousand feet above the planet Earth, and you got the candle fired up. You know, you got the right ambiance as you're in cruise control. Yeah. Over the ocean.
As it's crashing. I love you. Light the candle.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yep.
Crazy world we got going on, guys. Crazy world.
Crazy
can't
world.
Can't watch the news anymore. Can't.
Yeah.
I don't know. You see, Oregon basketball team was right outside their hotel room was right outside the...
Yeah,
you could tell the coach was visibly shaken up. He was just—he said, "I can't even talk about what I saw." Yeah. That's just—it's
awful
stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
Thankfully, the four college basketball teams that were there, including Arizona, Tulane was there. Luckily, everybody was safe and sound. A couple of the teams—one team was supposed to stay in Spain until the 25th, and it looks like they're going to alter their plans and come back early. Another one of the college teams had another exhibition game that got canceled, too.
Wow, that's just horrible.
Luckily, they're all safe and sound.
Alcasal was just distraught. I mean, because this was a big deal for him, you know, the basketball being there.
Oh, sure.
And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he's just, I just, you know... You don't know. You don't even want to watch the news. I don't.
You don't.
I don't even want to watch it.
Okay, Le'Veon Bell, you'll love this one, Sean. Did you read this story, Sean? NFL.com reported that Bell turned down a 5-year deal worth $60 million. The contract would have included $30 million in guaranteed money through the first 2 years and a total of $42 million over 3 years.
Wow.
Well, last year he thought he was probably the number two best wide receiver on the team. Give me $5 or $6 million more guaranteed. Come on.
This is Le'Veon Bell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, wasn't he suspended for steroids?
Oh, he's been... no.
Not steroids, no.
No, it's a violation of the NFL drug policy. And then...
Yeah, whatever. He was suspended. My point is, my God, they're offering you a lot of money when you couldn't play for a while because of your own doing. They should have fired you, you know, sent you on your way. But he's a great running back, but why would he turn down an offer like that? My God.
Well, let's see. According to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Bell's agent agreed to terms on the 5-year deal that would have kept the running back in Pittsburgh through 2021. However, before Bell could sign the contract, he decided it wasn't good enough and nixed it at the last minute, according to the Post-Gazette. Bell's decision... Well, here's the best line. Bell's decision apparently left the Steelers, quote, baffled.
$30 million guaranteed for a running back? A running back could go down. He's only as good as his next play. You know, yeah. He goes down the next play, he makes no money at all. So guaranteed $30 million, whether he gets hurt or not, he's insane. He'd be set for the rest of his life.
Now, Bell's agent says that is not how the negotiation went down.
No, of course not.
And then Adam Schefter reported that all stories to contrary are false. So that's... But, the money we're talking about is money all of us would be looking at saying, yeah, I can do that. Sure. I could do that. That sounds good.
I'm in.
Would that make him the highest paid running back?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I would think it would have to be in the neighborhood of being the highest paid running back.
Yeah, I don't know any other back that would be even close to making that money except for Peterson.
I mean, I think Bell is without question the best all-around running back in the NFL.
Oh, he's fantastic.
He's an excellent runner. He's really good on blitz pickup. He's one of the best at that. And he runs routes like a wide receiver does. Most running backs kind of float out of the backfield, circle out of the backfield. He doesn't. He runs routes, and he's really difficult to cover because he cuts on routes. He's very precise. And he does
a
lot of things really well.
Yeah.
But he's only played 2 playoff games in his entire career, and the Steelers have been in the playoffs every year.
He's hurt.
He keeps getting hurt.
Yeah.
NFL's highest paid running backs average salary per year for 2017. You got Jags rookie Leonard Fournette. He's going to make $6.8 million. Doug Martin, Tampa Bay, $7.2 million. LeSean McCoy at number 3, $8 million. Devontae Freeman at $8.3 million. And Le'Veon Bell, number 1, is at $12.1 million franchise tag.
Right, and they offered him 5 years, $60 million. And if he goes...
$12 million a year.
And if he makes it through 3 years, he gets $42 million guaranteed. If I'm sitting there and I'm Kevin Colbert, I too am baffled.
Wow, that's crazy! Again, a running back is one play away from ending his career.
Well,
that's just crazy.
I mean, the most important guy in that entire team, in terms of pure value, is Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one guy they can't afford to lose.
True.
Oh, absolutely. The wheels will come completely off the bus if that happens. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's...
Forget it.
Right. And that's just a simple fact of life. I mean, maybe Bell's a better player. Maybe Antonio Brown's a better player. But the one guy you can't afford to lose is Roethlisberger. Oh, well.
Another class act, anyway. But he is a great quarterback. I can't wait for football to start. Oh, my God. You guys, you don't watch Big Brother.
No.
I'm locked in on that show. Oh, my God. Last night was a Super Bowl. Double eviction. Jeez, I couldn't sleep. And then I had a dream about my old chair. my lazy
that
boy.
Thing. That
oh,
thing.
Oh, I love that chair. It's in a
I know
dump
you did.
Somewhere.
Nah. I know you did. It's in a
it's
landfill.
In a dump. Yeah. A poor thing. So. I'm hungry. We gotta go feed a rabbit. So.
You gotta go feed a rabbit. I'm gonna go to Harrisburg again. I've been debating all day about the end of the world thing with the eclipse.
Let me know if you hear anything about that.
And I'm just,
we'll be
what
outside
I'm do
with
is,
our welding helmets on looking at it. So.
Yeah, that's what Dad did. Remember, Dad went out and did that.
Yeah, remember that?
Yep.
At the old shop.
I'm out there with that cardboard white thing, like, holding it up. And, of course, I got nothing out of it. Yeah, and he's there with a welding helmet looking up at it. I'm like, oh, no, well, okay.
Yeah. I know. Everybody gets all built up about it, and then it's done in like 30 seconds, and then you're all right.
Well, it's going to start here in State College about 1:14.
What time does it end?
And then it peaks at 2:38. And then it starts to obviously dissipate after that till about 4 o'clock when it's okay. And the most it'll be obliterated here will be about 77%. So 23% still visible. Yeah.
Yeah, ours is 70%. So. Yeah, it's
all
pretty
right.
Cool. You know?
The master of two hearts, one flame. There he is.
Got to copyright that. I'm telling you.
Hey, I didn't get my autographed picture of Sean.
We're working on it.
You promised me.
I know. You'll get it.
Personalized, Sean. You can go on the Wall of Fame here.
I got to find the right picture. I got to find the right pose for you.
I want bare belly. Bare belly with a flex.
Oh, jeez.
I think it's going to be a long time until you get that picture.
Yeah. Why? That'd be cool. No, seriously, I want the picture for our Wall of Fame.
No, I don't want to scare Claire, all right?
Well, you should get the...
She likes you.
We should send a picture of the three of us together.
That was great.
Well, we got that. Yeah,
awesome.
Well, then I want two. I've already got one of Steve. So I need Sean, and then we can do the three of us. You two can sign it, and then I'll sign it.
Yeah.
So I have my old
and then people will come into the shop and go, wow, who are those people?
What are you, weird, man?
You say, those are the other two that follow my lead on the show.
That's right. Okay, do you want to see the two people I carry every Friday? There they are.
I want a raise.
You know what? We're more than happy to work that out with you. In fact,
instead
we'll have
of two pickles this year, I want three.
Done.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we can work that out.
Oh, that's no problem at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Brewers Outlet, the best going? What the heck?
Best pickles in the world, man. Best pickles in the world. Yeah,
they are
very good. They helped us with our ride home. So.
There you go. Perfect. All right. Have a great weekend.
All right. You too.
Talk to you next week.
I'm Van Riper. We'll join us next half hour here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
True refreshment can come in many forms, but it can only be found in one place, the Beverage Supermarket, Brewers Outlet in Sunbury. Along with their great selection of beer, including imports and microbrews, they have lots of water, soda, fresh roasted peanuts, and an unbelievable variety of pickles at the pickle bar. Look for great deals on wine coolers and your favorite snacks, too. Get true refreshment all in one place, the Beverage Supermarket, Brewers Outlet in Sunbury.
Sunbury Motors Kia had their best July in 5 years.
Thanks to the drastic discounts on all new Kias.
Guess what? SMC is doing it again in August.
Wanna see you in Kia. Sunbury Motors Kia.
those drastic discounts are extended into August at SMC. And there are 76 new Kias to choose from. 2017 Kia Fortes start at $15,997. 2017 Kia Souls as low as $16,698. The 2017 hybrid CUV, the Kia Niro, starting at $22,879. Plus, Sunbury Motors Kia has accepted a special shipment of 5 2017 Serenos that are priced at just $24,989. And SMC has financing as low as 0% for up to 66 months. And all include Kia's 10-year, 100,000-mile limited powertrain warranty. Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip in Hummel's Wharf and at sunburymotorskia.com.
Tax and tax extra. Offer expires 8/31/17. Restrictions apply. Warranty is limited powertrain warranty. For details, see retailer, go to kia.com.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. Final half hour. We start out with the sports bozo of the day. And we're going to go with Michigan football. And here's the reason why. We all know that Jim Harbaugh does not put out a depth chart during the season. And last year, for example, Colorado put out a mock depth chart of its own, of its football team, which then Harbaugh referred to as, I think the word he used was childish or something like that. The rest of us, of course, thought it was funny that they did that because this is not the National Security Council. But Jim Harbaugh, we all know, is about gamesmanship. As Michigan's coach, he's become notorious for not announcing starting quarterbacks. That's fine. Have no problem with that. He even ceased the practice of releasing and exchanging depth charts during game week. Now, that affects guys like me, but, look, I'll sit down, I'll put on a tape, I'll figure out my own depth chart. That's fine. It takes extra time, but that's fine. I'm a professional. I'm far more willing to do it. It's no big deal. If you check Michigan's football roster, you'll see that it has not been updated since the 2016 season. There is no rule saying that schools have to update their roster. But we're used to seeing schools do a full-scale update in July prior to media days, if not earlier in the year to reflect updates from spring practice. NJ.com, specifically NJ Advanced Media, contacted Michigan in an effort to get an updated roster. Why? Because they're going to do a feature on the New Jersey players and how many of them are on the Michigan roster. Now, for Michigan recruiting, this is a good story. It's an area you want to be into. Penn State's been in New Jersey for years. Michigan, guys like Rashawn Gary and so forth, are there. Michigan responded that the 2017 roster will not be posted until the first game of the first game week. Michigan choosing not to release a roster seems a little bit over the top, so NJ Advanced Media upped the ante and they filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the roster. The University of Michigan said it would respond to the request on or before August 25th. Well, okay, that's Friday, August 25th. 1 week and a day before the Wolverines' first game against Florida. Of course, last year, Colorado made up a fake depth chart for the Michigan game, including Eric Cartman at left tackle, Clark W. Griswold at tight end, and Elmer Fudd at quarterback. Michigan. All right. At least that's a fun story on our sports bozo of the day. Some great pennant races over the years. There aren't as many this year. There are a couple this year that are pretty good. The Dodgers are great this year. Back in 73, the Reds and the Dodgers were two teams that went head-to-head. Some of the great names in the game. Tom Van Riper has written a book. It is entitled Cincinnati Red and Dodger Blue, the Unknown Rivalry. We welcome Tom to the show. Tom, great to have you with us on the show.
Sure, Steve. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what was it that intrigued you about this rivalry, especially about these two teams from the 70s?
Well, it's funny. Growing up, I was a kid from Long Island. I was a big New York Mets fan as a young kid in that era. I was not particularly a fan, of the Reds or the Dodgers at that time.
Big Bud Harrelson, Felix Mian guy.
Yeah, absolutely. My idol was Tom Seaver, but
there
I loved Matlack and Harrelson and Mion and Cleon Jones and that whole group.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was basically the highlight of my childhood was when they knocked off the Reds in the 1973 National League playoffs.
Yeah, but is that the one where Bud Harrelson took on Pete Rose at second?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He became famous for the Rose-Harrelson fight in Game 3, which was really bizarre. And that kind of got most of the attention. But it kind of overshadowed, you know, some other things. You know, the Reds just not hitting as great as they were at that time, just not hitting that Met pitching staff, and just kind of shows what can happen over five games. You just never know.
And then, of course, this all came out of after the Dodgers and the Reds went head to head. And was this a rivalry born out of? Sometimes rivalries are born by location and long history. Others are born out of performance. Is this one that was born out of performance?
Oh, well, certainly. And I know to today's younger crowd, no one thinks of the Cincinnati Reds and the LA Dodgers as rivals, so to speak.
Right.
It doesn't have the geography. It doesn't have the long history like the Dodgers have with the Giants or like you have with the Red Sox, Yankees, you know. But, you know, divisional play in baseball only began in 1969 with the expansion that year. Prior to that, of course, it was just, you know, one slate of teams without any divisions. And when divisional play began in 1969, the Reds, even though it was kind of geographically wrong, the Reds were placed into the National League West along with the LA Dodgers. And within a couple of years, both teams became powers. The Dodgers had the great drafting of the late 60s, which really started to bear fruit in the early 70s. And the Reds were just getting going with their Big Red Machine era, which started really in 1970. So by about 72, you had both teams, really outstanding teams, in the same division, and at the same time, the other more traditional rivalries were a little bit dormant. You know, Yankees-Red Sox was not as big a deal then because the Baltimore Orioles in that era were dominating the American League East.
Right.
And so you had the Dodgers against the Reds as really kind of the primary show in baseball in terms of their regular season clashes. And, you know, my big memory, and the reason I think what compelled me to think about it was, since you didn't have ESPN or MLB Network or any of that stuff back then, the showcase events like the All-Star Game and the postseason were got even much bigger ratings than they do now. Those national telecasts of those showcase events were really a big deal, where it seemed like the whole country was turning in. And when you turned on those events in those days, these were the guys you saw. You know, Steve Garvey and Ron Say and Pete Rose and Joe Morgan and Johnny Bench. There were some years where as many as seven of the nine guys in the National League starting lineup in the All-Star Game were from these two teams. In the World Series, one or the other was in it, I believe, 7 years out of nine, from 1970 through 78. So these were really the definitive guys of the 70s. When you weren't following your own team day-to-day, like I was with the Mets and like lots of other people were doing around the country, you tuned into the national broadcast, and these were the guys you were seeing year after year. They were just a big force in baseball.
Yeah, I've said that many, many times on the show, that for me growing up, it was the Saturday game of the week,
the
All-Star game, and then we finally got a chance to see the playoffs and the World Series. That's how we ended up seeing players from other teams. I want to start with the Dodgers. The third base coach for the Dodgers was Tommy Lasorda, because Walter Alston was still the manager then, I believe.
Right. And Lasorda took over in 77. Right?
Yeah. And Lasorda had been coaching at Albuquerque, which meant he was with, say, for a little bit, Russell, Davey Lopes, Steve Garvey. What kind of role did that play in their comfort level going to the majors that Tommy was there actually with them as a third base coach?
Yeah, you know, in speaking to some of these guys, they said there was that continuity with the way the Dodgers like to run their farm system. Lasorda was a big organizational man. He had been the Dodger third base coach for, I think, 3 years before he became the manager. But before that, and I think this was really even more instrumental, he was a manager in the Dodger system. He managed the Spokane Indians in 1970. Steve Garvey said we were probably the greatest minor league team of all time. They finished in first place by 26 games.
Yeah.
They rolled through the playoffs. They had Garvey and Bill Buckner and Tom Pachurik, if you remember some of these other names, Von Joshua,
yeah.
Charlie Huff was on that team. They had something like seven or eight guys who made it up to the Dodgers a few years later, or even in some cases a year or two later. You can even go back a little bit before Ron Say. I had the chance to interview him, and he told me that in addition to kind of the basic minor league structure, the Dodgers had this separate sort of fast-track camp in Mesa, Arizona, which was just a separate thing they did for several weeks that highlighted just kind of the premier prospects, like, say, in Garvey and some of the other guys. And Tommy Lasorda ran that for a while. So all these guys came up under Lasorda in the system, either as kind of a minor league coordinator running the fast track camp or managing the minor league teams. So, you had that continuity. I don't know exactly how popular Lasorda was with the other guys compared to Walter Alston.
Right.
Not that he was unpopular.
Right.
But
I understand what you're saying, though.
I'm not sure.
Alston was like grandpa.
Yeah, and it was an interesting contrast because Walter Alston was kind of that strong, silent type. He was a very quiet guy, commanded a lot of respect in sort of a quiet way, and that was his style. Lasorda, of course, 180 degrees different. He comes in 1977, and he's this bundle of energy, right? He courts the press, he bleeds Dodger blue, the whole thing. And, you know, each guy had his style, but I think you have to credit Lasorda with kind of injecting some new energy, renewed energy, I should say, into the Dodgers, because as the rivalry was going great for a couple of years in the early to mid-70s, the Reds kind of started to dominate for a couple of years at the end of Alston's tenure, 1975 and 76. They pretty much ran away with it, and then went on to win the World Series in both of those years. And when Lasorda came in 77 with this whole different style, the Dodgers came back and got to the World Series that year. So a lot of people do credit the transition to Lasorda with kind of, you know, giving some renewed energy into the Dodgers, and by extension kind of giving the rivalry another few years that it lived on kind of into the early 80s.
The Reds were, at this point, really starting to become that 75-76 dynasty that you talked about, because at this point now they've got Tony Perez, they've got Dave Concepcion, they've got Joe Morgan, they've got George Foster, Cesar Geronimo, Ken Griffey, Pete Rose. I mean, it's a pretty good group. And then they got Johnny Bench. But Johnny Bench had something happen to him in the offseason where he had, I think, he had a lung surgery before the season began, I believe. And in fact, the 72, I think, is the last time he ever hit 40 home runs. He was never quite the same since. How much of an effect did that have on him in the 73 season?
Yeah, I've heard Johnny Bench over the years say that in some interviews, that injury, he said, and of course, it's hard to pinpoint because Bench was still a great player for several more years.
No doubt.
But he said, yeah, after 72, I physically never quite felt the same. I mean, this guy was the MVP of the league in both 70 and 72. In 72, you know, he hits 40 homers, drives in 125, plus he's throwing out everybody on the bases. He was pretty much Mr. All-American. And you're right, he said, you know, I never quite felt the same after that. I mean, the next year, you know, he hits 25 homers and drives in 100 and plays great defense. But, he was not quite the dominant guy in Major League Baseball like he was for those two or three years at the beginning of the 70s.
Yeah. All right, I want to ask you about now when they actually get out and start playing. If they get to September, and they have a couple really big series, including a defining moment on September 21st of that year. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I found that game, you know, kind of looking up all the head-to-head battles that year between L.A. and Cincinnati. This is in 1973, which was the first year. I'd say the rivalry kind of started in 72, although the Reds made their move pretty quickly, and they pulled ahead by midseason. And by the end of the year, they won kind of comfortably. The Dodgers were still a younger, kind of up-and-coming team at the time. But by 73, the Dodgers really arrived to be, I would say, a legitimate co-power with the Reds. And the Dodgers, you know, had the lead at midseason, 11 games over the Reds. The Reds come storming back. They win 3 games in a row at Riverfront Stadium. They cut it down to 8 around midseason. Then they continue hot through the summer. By early September, the Reds have pulled ahead of the Dodgers with this phenomenal comeback. Finally, by late September, the Dodgers start to rebound a little bit. They're within 4.5 games, and they've got a 3-game head-to-head series coming up at Dodger Stadium starting on that Friday night, September 21st. So the Reds have pulled into the lead at this point, but the Dodgers still have some chance as they get down to about the last 10 games. They really kind of need a sweep at home that weekend to really stay in it realistically. So on that Friday night, September 21st, you've got Jack Billingham for the Reds against Claude Osteen for the Dodgers. The Dodgers get an early run. They lead 1-0 into the ninth inning, and they're three outs away from winning this series opening game. They've got Don Sutton and Tommy John waiting to pitch the next two games, which is, you know, going to give them a decent chance.
Right.
And in the top of the ninth inning, George Foster, who at that time was a guy who had been up and down between AAA and the big leagues over the previous couple of years, not yet the established George Foster, you know, that who we would come to see a couple of years later. He comes up in the top of the ninth and drills one to left field. Home run over the fence. Reds tie the game in the ninth. Bottom of the ninth, the Dodgers don't score. Then in the top of the 10th, Osteen, this is a sign of the times, by the way, Claude Osteen is still pitching to begin the 10th, right? The starter is still
right
in there.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a completely different time.
Yeah. So in the top of the 10th, he gives up, I believe, a bunt single to the first hitter. Walter Alston finally takes him out, brings in Charlie Huff, who at that time is a young relief pitcher, and he gives up a base hit and then gives up a three-run blast to Tony Perez. The Reds go ahead 4-1. They retire the side in the bottom of the 10th. So the Reds tie in the 9th, win it in the 10th, and that kind of drives the final dagger into the Dodgers, pennant hopes for 73. It was kind of epitomized this season. You know, the LA is kind of right there, hanging right with the Reds. They're just about as good, but they don't quite have enough. That was the fifth time that year, by the way, in 18 games, that the Reds spoiled a Dodger lead in the ninth inning in head-to-head play in that season, and that really turned out to be the difference as to why the Reds won the division.
It's interesting. Marty Brenneman, of course, has been the signature voice of the Reds for decades now, but the irony is, based, you know, when we get to this, is that he didn't start till the year after this in 74. Al Michaels was the radio voice of the Reds.
Yep.
Vin Scully was the radio voice of the Dodgers. So it even extended into the booth, the quality.
I know. That was another thing I sort of stumbled upon as I started to do this. I thought, look at how many historic people, really, some players and some, like you said, broadcasters, that really were, you know, huge people in American sports in the following years that kind of have their roots in this rivalry. You had Al Michaels, a young Reds announcer. Vin Scully, of course, the Dodger announcer. Vin Scully was already pretty well-known at this point, but even he wasn't really a national network guy until a couple of years after this. You know, you could count Al Campanis, the Dodger general manager, who became, you know, unfortunately kind of infamous for these, you know, racial remarks that he made in the 1980s on when he went on that famous Nightline segment with Ted Koppel. And regardless of whether people debate that, I mean, without getting into all that too much, I guess, regardless of whether you think Al Campanis said something racist or just committed a little bit of a verbal gaffe, his appearance that night did turn out to be a pretty big event because it really did change the course of the conversation in terms of minority hiring in baseball and so forth. And then you look at the players, right? The first free agent in baseball was Andy Messersmith from those Dodger teams.
That's right.
You had Tommy John, the first Tommy John surgery guy.
Yep.
You know, and even some other trivia questions. You know, who gave up Henry Aaron's 715th home run?
Al Downing,
another Dodger pitcher.
Yeah.
You could extend it another trivia, you know, thing, even though it's really just a one-time thing, but, you know, Bill Buckner, who was a Dodger, probably made the most famous error and maybe the most famous play in the history of the World Series, which,
yeah,
unfortunately for him, because I don't think Boston losing the 86 World Series was his fault, but, you know, it still became a very, very famous play and a signature moment in baseball. So there are a lot of big things that trace back to these two teams.
Writing any book is exhausting, far more than people realize. What did you learn along the way that opened your eyes and even surprised you when you were doing your research?
That's a good question. I think what surprised me was a couple of things probably about the Cincinnati Reds, because, of course, I knew generally, like most people do, that they were a great club and that they had a lot of success and that they drew very well, that they have even though it's a small market, Cincinnati is quite a passionate fan base and always has. I was a little surprised when I went through the attendance as to how much both the Dodgers and the Reds just dominated the rest of baseball at the gate. I wasn't that surprised about it with the Dodgers because that's the perfect storm. Not only an excellent team in those days, but, you know, it's L.A., big market, perfect weather, you know, no cold games in April.
Big ballpark.
Yeah. Cincinnati, though, I was not surprised to learn that they drew well, but the degree to which they were outdrawing other similar types of teams really surprised me because in that era, you had other strong teams. And, you know, like the Reds, strong teams in medium or smaller markets. You had the Oakland A's dominating. You had the Baltimore Orioles in their division. You had the Pirates in their division, you know, winning 5 out of 6 NL East titles, right, from 70 to 75.
And not one of the three drew well.
No, the Pirates did okay. They were kind of league average, but Oakland was not drawing flies, even in those three straight World Series. I mean, they were barely drawing a million fans. One year, they were under a million. You know, they were getting 12,000 a game.
Yeah.
The Orioles didn't draw very well either, and they had those powerful teams in the early to mid-70s. So the Reds are drawing, you know, over 2 million fans, which was a big number in that era.
Yep.
And it's, you know, basically double what Oakland and Pittsburgh and Baltimore are drawing. That surprised me that Cincinnati was that much better at the gate than those other teams that were kind of in similar circumstances. You know, very good teams playing in smaller markets. Just kind of underlies how strong and kind of passionate that baseball fan base is in Cincinnati.
Tom, an absolute pleasure. The book is entitled Cincinnati Red and Dodger Blue, Baseball's Greatest Forgotten Rivalry. Tom, thanks so much for the time today and a fascinating look back.
Oh, I appreciate it, Steve. I never get tired of talking about this.
I'm sure you don't, Tom. Thanks so much. Appreciate it very much. All right. That wraps up the show for this week. Great to have you with us, as always, throughout the course of the week. I understand that we had great numbers on the podcast for the Spider Caldwell interview. And just for fun, I know we're going to revisit that on Monday. Just because we had such great response to it, it'd be great to hear him again. Sean, great to have you back in the chair, my man. Means a lot. And a week from tonight, high school football begins. Wow. Have a great weekend, everyone. Appreciate it, as always.
Four city blocks of new Fords. Over 40,000 trucks sold. SMC is where you want to be. At Sunbury Motors, you can choose from over 100 new Ford trucks with discounts as high as $13,500. 2017 Ford F-150s are priced as low as $24,419.
See why one is sold every 43 seconds.
There goes another one. Choose from over 60 new 2017 Ford Escapes, and they start at just $19,880. Lease a 2017 Ford C-Max Energy for only $169 a month with zero down.
This amazing vehicle gets up to 95 mpg.
Plus, get 0% financing for up to 72 months on 2017 Ford Fusions, Escapes, Edges, and Explorers. SMC is where you want to be in August for the largest selection and massive discounts on new Fords. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, proudly serving the Susquehanna Valley and all of Central PA for over a century.
Exact Energy leases for 36 months with zero down, tax and tags included. 10,500 miles per year. See dealer for details.
We're your home for news, sports, weather, and your home for the Phillies, News Radio 1070 WKOK, Sunbury.